tugging the hood back up. They lifted off, going straight up for a long time before they started to head for the hotel in the module. The drone said nothing. Gurgay was silent too, watching the great galaxy of lights that was the city as it passed beneath his feet. They got back to the module. The roof door opened for them as they fell, and the lights came on after it closed again. Gurgay stood for a while as the drone took the cloak from him and unclipped the AG harness. Slipping down off his shoulders, the removal of the harness left him with an odd sensation of nakedness.
"I've one more thing I'd like to show you," the drone said.
It moved down the corridor to the module lounge. Gurgay followed it. Flea Imsaho floated in the center of the room. The screen was on, showing an apex and a male copulating. Background music surged. The setting was plush with cushions and thick drapes.
"This is an Imperial Select channel," the drone said. "Level 1. Mildly scrambled."
The scene switched, then switched again, each time showing a slightly different mix of sexual activity, from solo masturbation through to groups involving all three Azadian sexes.
"This sort of thing is restricted," the drone said. "Visitors aren't supposed to see it. The unscrambling apparatus is available for a price on the general market, however. Now, we'll see some level 2 channels. These are restricted to the Empire's bureaucratic, military, religious, and commercial upper echelons."
The screen went briefly hazy with a swirl of random colors, then cleared to show some more Azadians, mostly naked or very scantily clad. Again, the emphasis was on sexuality, but there was another, new element in what was happening. Many of the people wore very strange and uncomfortable-looking clothes, and some were being tied up and beaten, or put into various absurd positions in which they were sexually used. Females dressed in uniforms ordered males and apices around. Gurgay recognized some of the uniforms as those worn by Imperial Navy officers. Others looked like exaggerations of more ordinary uniforms. Some of the apices were dressed in male clothes, some in female dress. Apices were made to eat their own or somebody else's excreta, or drink their urine. The wastes of other pan-human species seemed to be particularly prized for this practice. Mouths and anuses, animals and aliens were penetrated by males and apices. Aliens and animals were persuaded to mount the various sexes, and objects, some everyday, some apparently specially made, were used as phallic substitutes. In every scene, there was an element of... Gurgay supposed it was dominance. He'd been only mildly surprised that the Empire wanted to hide the material shown on the first level. A people so concerned with rank and protocol and clothed dignity might well want to restrict such things, harmless though they might be. The second level was different. He thought it gave the game away a little, and he could understand them being embarrassed about it. It was clear that the delight being taken in level 2 was not the vicarious pleasure of watching people enjoying themselves and identifying with them, but in seeing people being humiliated while others enjoyed themselves at their expense. Level 1 had been about sex. This was about something the Empire obviously thought more of, but could not disentangle from that act.
"Now, level 3, the drone said.
Gurgay watched the screen. Flea Imsaho watched Gurgay. The man's eyes glittered in the screen light, unused photons reflecting from the halo of iris. The pupils widened at first, then shrank, became pinpoints. The drone waited for the wide staring eyes to fill with moisture, for the tiny muscles around the eyes to flinch and the eyelids to close and the man to shake his head and turn away. But nothing of the sort happened. The screen held his gaze, as though the infinitesimal pressure of light it spent upon the room had somehow reversed, and so sucked the watching man forward to hold him teetering before the fall, fixed and steady and pointed at the flickering surface like some long-stilled moon. The screams echoed through the lounge, over its form seats and couches and low tables. The screams of apices, men, women, children. Sometimes they were silenced quickly, but usually not. Each instrument and each part of the tortured people made its own noise. Blood, knives, bones, lasers, flesh, ripsaws, chemicals, leeches, fleshworms, vibraguns, even phalluses, fingers and claws. Each made or produced their own distinctive sounds, counterpoints to the theme of screams. The final scene the man watched featured a psychotic male criminal previously injected with massive doses of sex hormones and hallucinogens, a knife, and a woman described as an enemy of the state, who was pregnant and just before term. The eyes closed. His hands went to his ears. He looked down.
"Enough," he muttered.
Fleer Imsaho switched the screen off. The man rocked backward on his heels, as though there had indeed been some attraction, some artificial gravity from the screen, and now that it had ceased, he almost overbalanced in reaction.
"That one is live, Junaguke. It is taking place now. It is still happening. Deep in some cellar under a prison or a police barracks."
Gurge looked up at the blank screen, eyes still wide and staring but dry. He gazed, rocked backward and forward, and breathed deeply. There was sweat on his brow, and he shivered.
"Level 3 is for the ruling elite only. Their strategic military signals are given the same encrypting status. I think you can see why. This is no special night, Gurge. No festival of Sado-erotica. These go out every evening. There is more, but you've seen a representative cross-section."
Gurge nodded. His mouth was dry. He swallowed with some difficulty, took a few more deep breaths, rubbed his beard. He opened his mouth to speak, but the drone spoke first.
"One other thing. Something else they kept from you. I didn't know this myself until last night, when the ship mentioned it. Ever since you played Ram, your opponents have been on various drugs as well. Cortex-keyed amphetamines, at least. But they have far more sophisticated drugs which they use, too. They have to inject or ingest them. They don't have gene-affixed glands to manufacture drugs in their own bodies, but they certainly use them. Most of the people you've been playing have had far more artificial chemicals and compounds in their bloodstream than you've had."
The drone made a sighing noise. The man was still staring at the dead screen.
"That's it," the drone said. "I'm sorry if what I've shown you has upset you, Jernogurge. But I didn't want you to leave here thinking the Empire was just a few venerable game players, some impressive architecture and a few glorified nightclubs. What you've seen tonight is also what it's about. And there's plenty in between that I can't show you. All the frustrations that affect the poor and the relatively well-off alike, caused simply because they live in a society where one is not free to do as one chooses. There's the journalist who can't write what he knows is the truth. The doctor who can't treat somebody in pain because they're the wrong sex. A million things every day. Things that aren't as melodramatic and gross as what I've shown you, but which are still part of it, still some of the effects. The ship told you a guilty system recognizes no innocence. I'd say it does. It recognizes the innocence of a young child, for example, and you saw how they treated that. In a sense, it even recognizes the sanctity of the body, but only to violate it. Once again, Gurge, it all boils down to ownership, possession, about taking and having."
Fleer Imsaho paused, then floated toward Gurge, came very close to him.
"Ah, but I'm preaching again, am I? The excesses of youth. I've kept you up late. Maybe you're ready for some sleep now. It's been a long night, hasn't it? I'll leave you."
It turned and floated away. It stopped near the door again.
"Good night,"
it said. Gurge cleared his throat. "Good night," he said, looking away from the dark screen at last. The drone dipped and disappeared. Gurge sat down on a form seat. He stared at his feet for a while, then got up and walked outside the module into the roof garden. The dawn was just coming up. The city looked washed out somehow, and cold. The many lights burned weakly, brilliant sapped by the calm blue vastness of the sky. A guard at the stairwell entrance coughed and stamped his feet, though Gurge could not see him. He went back into the module and lay down on his bed. He lay in the darkness without closing his eyes, then closed his eyes and turned over, trying to sleep. He could not, and neither could he bring himself to secrete something that would make him sleep. At last he got up and went back to the lounge where the screen was. He had the module access the game channels and sat there looking at his own game with Bamoya for a long time, without moving or speaking, and without a single molecule of glanded drug in his bloodstream. A prison ambulance stood outside the conference centre. Gergay got out of the aircraft and walked straight into the game hall. Pequil had to run to keep up with the man. The Apex didn't understand the alien. He hadn't wanted to talk during the journey from the hotel to the conference centre, whereas usually people in such a situation couldn't stop talking. And somehow, he didn't seem to be frightened at all, though Pequil couldn't see how that could be. If he hadn't known the awkward, rather innocent alien better, he'd have thought it was anger he could read on that discoloured, hairy, pointed face. Lo-Prenest Bamoya sat in a stool seat just off the board of origin. Gergay stood on the board itself. He rubbed his beard with one long finger, then moved a couple of pieces. Bamoya made his own moves, then, when the action spread, as the alien tried desperately to wriggle out of his predicament, the judge had some amateur players make most of his moves for him. The alien remained on the board making his own moves, scurrying to and fro like a giant dark insect. Bamoya couldn't see what the alien was playing at. His play seemed to be without purpose, and he made some moves which were either stupid mistakes or pointless sacrifices. Bamoya mopped up some of the alien's tattered forces. After a while, he thought perhaps the male did have a plan of sorts, but if so, it must be a very obscure one. Perhaps there was some kind of odd face-saving point the male was trying to make, while he still was a male. Who knew what strange precepts governed an alien's behaviour at such a moment? The moves went on, incoherent, unreadable. They broke for lunch. They resumed. Bamoya didn't return to the stool seat after the break. He stood at the side of the board, trying to work out what slippery, ungraspable plan the alien might have. It was like playing a ghost now. It was as though they were competing on separate boards. He couldn't seem to get to grips with the male at all. His pieces kept slipping away from him, moving as though the man had anticipated his next move before he'd even thought of it. What had happened to the alien? He'd played quite differently yesterday. Was he really receiving help from outside? Bamoya felt himself start to sweat. There was no need for it. He was still well ahead, still poised for victory. But suddenly he began to sweat. He told himself it was nothing to worry about, a side effect of some of the concentration boosters he'd taken over lunch. Bamoya made some moves which ought to settle what was going on, expose the alien's real plan if he had one. No result. Bamoya tried some more exploratory gestures, committing a little more to the attempt. Gergay attacked immediately. Bamoya had spent 100 years learning and playing Azad, and he'd sat in courts of every level for half that time. He'd seen many violent outbursts by just-sentenced criminals, and watched, and even taken part in, games containing moves of great suddenness and ferocity. Nevertheless, the alien's next few moves contrived to be on a level more barbarous and wild than anything Bamoya had witnessed in either context. Without the experience of the courts, he felt he might have physically reeled. Those few moves were like a series of kicks in the belly. They contained all the berserk energy the very best young players spasmodically exhibited, but marshalled, synchronized, sequenced, and unleashed with a style and a savage grace no untamed beginner could have hoped to command. With the first move, Bamoya saw what the alien's plan might be. With the next move, he saw how good the plan was. With the next, that the play might go on into the following day before the alien could finally be vanquished. With the next, that he, Bamoya, wasn't in quite as unassailable a position as he'd thought. And with the following two, that he still had a lot of work to do, and then that perhaps the play wouldn't last until tomorrow after all. Bamoya made his own moves again, trying every ploy and stratagem he'd learned in a century of game-playing. The disguised observation piece, the feint within the feint, using attack pieces and cardstock. The premature use of the board of becoming element pieces, making a swamp on the territories by the conjunction of earth and water. But nothing worked. He stood, just before the break, at the end of the afternoon session, and he looked at the alien. The hall was silent. The alien male stood in the middle of the board, staring impassively at some minor piece, rubbing at the hair on his face. He looked calm, unperturbed. Bamoya surveyed his own position. Everything was in a mess. There was nothing he could do now, beyond redemption. It was like some badly prepared, fundamentally flawed case, or some piece of equipment three-quarters destroyed. There was no saving it. Better to throw it out and start again. But there was no starting again. He was going to be taken out of here and taken to hospital and spayed. He was going to lose that which made him what he was, and he would never be allowed to have it back. Gone forever. Forever. Bamoya couldn't hear the people in the hall. He couldn't see them either, or see the board beneath his feet. All he could see was the alien male, standing tall and insect-like, with his sharp-featured face and his angular body, and stroking his furred face with one long, dark finger, the two-part nails at its tip showing the lighter skin beneath. How could he look so unconcerned? Bamoya fought the urge to scream. A great breath surged out of him. He thought how easy this had all looked this morning, how fine it had felt that not only would he be going to the Fire Planet for the final games, but also that he would be doing the Imperial Office a great favour at the same time. Now he thought that perhaps they had always known this might happen, and they wanted him humiliated and brought down. For some reason he could not know, because he had always been loyal and conscientious. A mistake. It had to be a mistake. But why now, he thought. Why now? Why this time of all times? Why this way for this bet? Why had they wanted him to do this thing and make this wager when he had within him the seed of a child? Why? The alien rubbed his furry face, pursed his strange lips as he looked down at some point on the board. Bamoya began to stumble toward the male, oblivious of the obstacles in his way, trampling the biotechs on the other pieces under his feet and crashing over the raised pyramids of higher ground. The male looked round at him as though seeing him for the first time. Bamoya felt himself stop. He gazed into the alien eyes and saw nothing. No pity, no compassion, no spirit of kindness or sorrow. He looked into those eyes, and at first he thought of the look criminals had sometimes when they'd been sentenced to a quick death. It was a look of indifference, not despair, not hatred, but something flatter and more terrifying than either. A look of resignation, of all hope gone, a flag hoisted by a soul that no longer cared. Yet, although in that instant of recognition the doomed convict was the first image Bamoya clutched at, he knew immediately it was not the fit one. He did not know what the fit one was. Perhaps it was unknowable. Then he knew, and suddenly, for the first time in his life, he understood what it was for the condemned to look into his eyes. He fell, to his knees at first, thudding down onto the board, cracking raised areas, then forward onto his face, eyes level with the board, seeing it from the ground at last. He closed his eyes. The adjudicator and his helpers came over to him and gently lifted him. Paramedics strapped him to the stretcher, sobbing quietly, and carried him outside to the prison ambulance. Pequil stood amazed. He had never thought he would see an Imperial judge break down like that, and in front of the alien. He had to run after the dark man. He was striding back out of the hall as quickly and quietly as he'd arrived, ignoring the hisses and shouts from the public galleries around him. They were in the air car before even the press could catch up, speeding away from the game hall. Gergay, Pequil realized, had not said a single word the whole time they'd been in the hall. Fleer Imsaho watched the man. He had expected more of a reaction, but he did nothing except sit at the screen, watching replays of all the games he'd played since he'd arrived. He wouldn't talk. He would be going to Akronidal now, along with 119 other fourth-round single-game winners. As was usual after a bet of such severity had been honoured, the family of the now mutilated Bamoya had resigned for him. Without moving a piece on either of the two remaining great boards, Gergay had won the match and his place on the Fire Planet. Some 20 days remained between the end of Gergay's game against Bamoya and the date when the Imperial Court's fleet departed for the 12-day journey to Akronidal. Gergay had been invited to spend part of that time at an estate owned by Hamin, the rector of the ruling College of Kansev, and mentor to the Emperor. Fleer Imsaho had advised him against it, but Gergay accepted. They would leave tomorrow for the estate, a few 100 kilometers distant on an island in an inland sea. Gergay was taking what the drone believed was an unhealthy, even perverse, interest in what the news and press agencies were saying about him. The man seemed to actually relish the calumnies and invective poured upon him following his win over Bemoya. Sometimes he smiled when he read or heard what they said about him, especially when the newsreaders, in shocked, reverent tones, related what the alien Gergay had caused to be done to low-prenest Bemoya, a gentle, lenient judge with 5 wives and 2 husbands, though no children. Gergay had also started to watch the channels which showed the imperial troops crushing the savages and infidels it was civilizing in distant parts of the empire. He had the module unscramble the higher-level military broadcasts which the services put out. It seemed in a spirit of competition with the court's more highly encrypted entertainment channels. The military broadcasts showed scenes of alien executions and tortures. Some showed the buildings and artworks of the recalcitrant or rebellious species being blown up or burned. Things only very rarely shown on the standard news channels, if for no other reason than that all aliens were depicted as a matter of course as being uncivilized monsters, docile simpletons, or greedy and treacherous subhumans, all categories incapable of producing high art and genuine civilization. Sometimes, where physically possible, Azadian males, though never apices, were shown raping the savages. It upset Fleer Imsaho that Gergay should enjoy watching such things, especially as it had been instrumental in introducing him to the scrambled broadcasts in the first place. But at least he didn't appear to find the sights sexually stimulating. He didn't dwell on them the way the drone knew Azadians tended to. He looked, registered, then flicked away again. He still spent the majority of his time staring at the games shown on the screen. But the coded signals and his own bad press kept drawing him back, time and again, like a drug. "But I don't like rings."
"It isn't a question of what you like, Jirno Gergay. When you go to Hammond's estate, you'll be outside this module. I might not always be close by. And anyway, I'm not a specialist in toxicology. You'll be eating their food and drinking their drink, and they have some very clever chemists and exobiologists. But if you wear one of these on each hand, index finger preferably, you should be safe from poisoning. If you feel a single jab, it means a non-lethal drug, such as a hallucinogen. 3 jabs means somebody's out to waste you."
"What do 2 jabs mean?"
"I don't know. A malfunction, probably. Now, will you put them on?"
"They don't really suit me."
"Would a shroud?"
"They feel funny."
"Never mind if they work."
"How about a magic amulet to ward off bullets?"
"Are you serious? I mean, if you are, there is a passive sensor impact shield jewelry set on board, but they'd probably use crews."
Gergay waved one ringed hand. "Oh, never mind." He sat down again, turning on a military execution channel. The drone found it difficult to talk to the man. He wouldn't listen. It attempted to explain that despite all the horrors he had seen in the city and on the screen, there was still nothing the culture could do that wouldn't do more harm than good. It tried to tell him that the contact section, the whole culture in fact, was like him, dressed in his cloak and standing unable to help the man lying injured in the street, that they had to stick to their disguise and wait until the moment was right. But either its arguments weren't getting through to him, or that wasn't what the man was thinking about, because he made no response and wouldn't enter into a discussion about it. Fleer Imsaho didn't go out much during the days between the end of the game with Bemoya and the journey to Hammond's estate. Instead, it stayed in with the man, worrying.
"Mr. Gergay, I am pleased to meet you."
The old Apex put out his hand. Gergay grasped it.
"I hope you had a pleasant flight here, yes?"
"We did, thank you," Gergay said. They stood on the roof of a low building, set in luxuriant green vegetation and looking out over the calm waters of the inland sea. The house was almost submerged in the burgeoning greenery. Only the roof was fully clear of the swaying treetops. Nearby were paddocks full of riding animals, and from the various levels of the house, long sweeping gantries, elegant and slim, soared out through the crowding trunks above the shady forest floor, giving access to the golden beaches and the pavilions and summer houses of the estate. In the sky, huge sunlit clouds piled sparkling over the distant mainland.
"You say oui,"
Hammond said, as they walked across the roof and liveried males took Gergay's baggage from the aircraft. "The drone, Fleer Imsaho and I," Gergay said, nodding to the bulky, buzzing machine at his shoulder.
"Ah, yes."
The old Apex laughed, bald head reflecting the binary light.
"The machine some people thought let you play so well."
They descended to a long balcony set with many tables, where Harmin introduced Gergay, and the drone, to various people, mostly apices plus a few elegant females. There was only one person Gergay already knew. The smiling Loshev Olos put down a drink and rose from his table, taking Gergay's hand.
"Mr. Gergay, how good to see you again. Your luck held out, and your skill increased. A formidable achievement. Congratulations once again."
The apex's gaze flicked momentarily to Gergay's ringed fingers. "Thank you. It was at a price I'd have willingly forgone."
"Indeed. You never cease to surprise us, Mr. Gergay."
"I'm sure I shall, eventually."
"You are too modest."
Olos smiled and sat down. Gergay declined the offer to visit his rooms and freshen up. He felt perfectly fresh already. He sat at a table with Harmin, some other directors of Kantsev College, and a few court officials. Chilled wines and spiced snacks were served. Fleer Imsaho settled relatively quietly on the floor by Gergay's feet. Gergay's new rings appeared to be happy there was nothing more damaging than alcohol in the fare being served. The conversation mostly avoided Gergay's last game. Everyone pronounced his name correctly. The college directors asked him about his unique game style. Gergay answered as best he could. The court officials inquired politely about his homeworld, and he told them some nonsense about living on a planet. They asked him about Fleer Imsaho, and Gergay expected the machine to answer, but it didn't, so he told them the truth. The machine was a person by the culture's definition. It could do as it liked, and it did not belong to him. One tall and strikingly beautiful female, a companion of Loshav Olos, who'd come over to join their table, asked the drone if its master played logically or not. Fleer Imsaho replied, with a trace of weariness Gergay suspected only he could detect, that Gergay was not its master, and that it supposed he thought more logically than it did when he was playing games, but that anyway it knew very little about Azad. They all found this most amusing. Harmin stood then and suggested that his stomach, with over 2.5 centuries of experience behind it, could tell it was approaching time for dinner better than any servant's clock. People laughed and gradually began to depart the long balcony. Harmin escorted Gergay to his room personally and told him a servant would let him know when the meal was to be served.
"I wish I knew why they invited you here," Fleer Imsaho said,
quickly unpacking Gergay's few cases while the man looked out of the window at the still trees and the calm sea. "Perhaps they want to recruit me for the Empire. What do you think, drone? Would I make a good general?"
"Don't be facetious, Jerno Gergay."
The drone switched to Moraine.
"And not to forget, random Domran here bugged, are we, nonsense wansons?"
Gergay looked concerned and said in Nyachik, "Heavens, drone, are you developing a speech impediment?"
"Gergay,"
the drone hissed, setting out some clothes the Empire deemed suitable to be worn when eating. Gergay turned away, smiling. "Maybe they just want to kill me."
"I wonder if they want any help."
Gergay laughed and came over to the bed where the drone had laid out the formal clothing. "It'll be all right."
"So you say, but we haven't even got the protection of the module here, let alone anything else. But let's not worry about it."
Gergay picked up a couple of the robe pieces and tried them against his body, holding them under his chin and looking down. "I'm not worried anyway," he said. The drone shouted at him in exasperation.
"Oh, you're now, Gergay. How many times do I have to tell you? You cannot wear red and green together like that."
"You like music, Mr. Gergay?"
Harmin asked, leaning over to the man. Gergay nodded. "Well, a little does no harm." Harmin sat back, apparently satisfied with this answer. They had climbed to the broad roof garden after dinner, which had been a long, complicated and very filling affair, during which naked females had danced in the centre of the room, and, if Gergay's rings were to be believed, nobody had tried to interfere with his food. It was dusk now, and the party was outside in the warm evening air, listening to the wailing music produced by a group of apex musicians. Slender gantries led from the garden into the tall, graceful trees. Gergay sat at a small table with Harmin and Olos. Fleer Imsaho sat near his feet. Lamps shone in the trees around them. The roof garden was its own island of light in the night, surrounded by the cries of birds and animals, calling out as though in answer to the music.
"I wonder, Mr. Gergay,"
Harmin said, sipping his drink and lighting a long, small-bowled pipe.
"Did you find any of our dancing girls attractive?"
He pulled on the long-stemmed pipe, then, with the smoke wreathing around his bald head, went on.
"I only ask because one of them, she with the silver streak in her hair, remember? did express rather an interest in you. I'm sorry. I hope I'm not shocking you, Mr. Gergay.
Am I?
Not in the least.
Well, I just wanted to say you're among friends here, yes? You've more than proved yourself in the game, and this is a very private place, outside the gaze of the press and the common people, who, of course, have to depend on certain hard and fast rules, whereas we do not, not here. You catch my drift. You may relax in confidence.
I'm most grateful. I shall certainly try to relax, but I was told before I came here that I would be found ugly, even disfigured by your people. Your kindness overwhelms me, but I would prefer not to inflict myself on somebody who might not be available through choice alone.
"'Too modest again, Jana Gurge,'
Olosh smiled. Harmin nodded, puffing on his pipe.
"'You know, Mr. Gurge, I have heard that in your culture you have no laws. I am sure this is an exaggeration, but there must be a grain of truth in the assertion, and I would guess you must find the number and strictness of our laws to be a great difference between your society and ours. Here we have many rules, and try to live according to the laws of God, game, and empire. But one of the advantages of having laws is the pleasure one may take in breaking them. We here are not children, Mr. Gergay.
Harmin waved the pipe stem round the tables of people.
Rules and laws exist only because we take pleasure in doing what they forbid. But as long as most of the people obey such prescriptions most of the time, they have done their job. Blind obedience would imply we are...
Harmin chuckled and pointed at the drone with the pipe.
No more than robots.
Fleer Imseho buzzed a little louder, but only momentarily. There was silence. Gurge drank from his glass. Olos and Harmin exchanged looks.
Jana Gurge,
Olos said at last, rolling his glass round in his hands.
Let us be frank. You are an embarrassment to us. You've done very much better than we expected. We did not think we could be so easily fooled, but somehow you did it. I congratulate you on whatever ruse it was you used, whether it centred on your drug glands, your machine there, or simply many more years playing Azad than you admitted to. You have bettered us, and we are impressed. I am only sorry that innocent people, such as those bystanders who were shot instead of you, and Lo Prinest Bamoya, had to be hurt. As you have no doubt guessed, we would like you to go no further in the game. Now, the Imperial Office has nothing to do with the Games Bureau, so there is little we can do directly. We do have a suggestion, though.
What's that? Gurge sipped his drink.
As I've been saying,
Harmin pointed the stem of a pipe at Gurge.
We have many laws. We therefore have many crimes. Some of these are of a sexual nature, yes?
Gurge looked down at his drink.
I need hardly point out, Harmin continued, that the physiology of our race makes us unusual, one might almost say gifted in that respect. Also, in our society, it is possible to control people. It is possible to make somebody, or even several people, do things they might not want to do. We can offer you, here, the sort of experience which, by your own admission, would be impossible on your own world.
The old Apex leaned closer, dropping his voice.
Can you imagine what it might be like to have several females and males, even apices if you like, who will do your every bidding?
Harmin knocked his pipe out on the table leg. The ash drifted over the humming bulk of Fleer Imseho. The rector of Kansev College smiled in a conspiratorial way and sat back, repacking his pipe from a small pouch. Olos leaned forward.
This whole island is yours for as long as you want it, Jana Gurge. You may have as many people of whatever sexual mix as you like for as long as you desire.
But I pull out of the game.
You retire, yes, Olos said.
Harmin nodded.
There are precedents.
The whole island. Gurge made a show of looking around the gently lit roof garden. A troop of dancers appeared. The lithe, skimpily dressed men, women, and apices made their way up some steps to a small stage raised behind the musicians.
Everything, Olo said. The island, house, servants, dancers, everything and everyone.
Gurge nodded, but didn't say anything. Harmin relit his pipe.
Even the band, he said, coughing.
He waved at the musicians.
What do you think of their instruments, Mr. Gergay? Do they not sound sweet?
Very pleasant. Gergay drank a little, watching the dancers arrange themselves on stage.
Even there, though, Harmin said, you are missing something. You see, we gain a great deal of pleasure from knowing at what cost this music is bought. You see the stringed instrument, the one on the left with the 8 strings?
Gergay nodded. Harmin said,
I can tell you that each of those steel strings has strangled a man. You see that white pipe at the back, played by the male?
The pipe shaped like a bone. Harmin laughed.
A female's femur, removed without anaesthetic.
Naturally, Gergay said, and took a few sweet-tasting nuts from a bowl on the table. Do they come in matched pairs, or are there a lot of one-legged lady music critics? Harmin smiled.
You see, he said to Olas, he does appreciate.
The old Apex gestured back at the band, behind whom the dancers were now arranged, ready to start their performance.
The drums are made from human skin. You can see why each set is called a family. Their horizontal percussion instrument is constructed from finger bones and, well, there are other instruments. But can you understand now why that music sounds so precious to those of us who know what has gone into the making of it?
Oh, yes, Gergay said. The dancers began. Fluid, practiced, they impressed almost immediately. Some must have worn AG units, floating through the air like huge, diaphanously slow birds.
Good, Harmin nodded. You see, Gergay, one can be on either side in the Empire. One can be the player, or one can be played upon.
Harmin smiled at what was a play on words in Iatric, and, to some extent, in Moraine, too. Gergay watched the dancers for a moment. Without looking away from them, he said, I'll play, Rector, on Ikronidal. He tapped one ring on the rim of his glass in time to the music. Harmin sighed.
Well, I have to tell you, Jana Gergay, that we are worried.
He pulled on the pipe again, studying the glowing bowl.
Worried about the effect you're getting any further in the game would have on the morale of our people. So many of them are just simple folk. It is our duty to shield them from the harsh realities sometimes. And what harsher reality can there be than the realization that most of one's kin are gullible, cruel, and foolish? They would not understand that a stranger, an alien, can come here and do so well at the holy game. We here, those of us in the court and the colleges, might not be so concerned, but we have to keep the ordinary, decent, I would even go as far as to say, innocent people in mind, Mr. Gergay. And what we have to do in that respect, what we sometimes have to take responsibility for, does not always make us happy. But we know our duty, and we will do it, for them and for our Emperor.
Harmin leaned forward again.
We don't intend to kill you, Mr. Gergay, though I'm told there are factions in the court who'd like nothing better, and they say, people in the security services easily capable of doing so. No, nothing so gross. But...
The old Apex sucked on the thin pipe, producing a gentle papping noise. Gergay waited. Harmin pointed the stem at him again.
I have to tell you, Gergay, that no matter how you do in the first game on Ikronidal, it will be announced that you have been defeated. We have unequivocal control of the communications and news services on the Fire Planet, and as far as the press and the public will be concerned, you will be knocked out in the first round there. We will do whatever has to be done to make it appear that that is exactly what has in fact happened. You are free to tell people I've told you this, and free to claim whatever you want after the event. You will be ridiculed, though, and what I have described will happen anyway. The truth has already been decided.
Olos's turn. So you see, Gergay, you may go to Ikronidal, but to certain defeat, absolute certain defeat. Go as a high-class tourist if you want, or stay here and enjoy yourself as our guest. But there is no longer any point in playing.
Gergay said.
The dancers were slowly losing their clothes as they stripped each other. Some of them, still dancing, were at the same time contriving to stroke and touch each other in an exaggeratedly sexual way. Gergay nodded.
I'll think about it.
Then he smiled at the two apices. I'd like to see your fire planet all the same. He drank from the cool glass and watched the slow build-up of erotic choreography behind the musicians. Other than that, though, I can't imagine I'll be trying too terribly hard. Harmin was studying his pipe. Olos looked very serious. Gergay held out his hands in a gesture of resigned helplessness. What more can I say?
Would you be prepared to cooperate, though? Olos said.
Gergay looked inquisitive. Olos reached slowly over and tapped the rim of Gergay's glass.
Something that would ring true? He said softly.
Gergay watched the two APCs exchange glances. He waited for them to make their play.
Documentary evidence,
Harmin said after a moment, talking to his pipe.
Film of you, looking worried over a bad board position. Maybe even an interview. We could arrange these things without your cooperation, naturally, but it would be easier, less fraught for all concerned, with your aid.
The old Apex sucked on his pipe. Olos drank, glancing at the romantic antics of the dance troupe. Gergay looked surprised.
You mean lie?
Participate in the construction of your false reality.
Our real reality, Gergay, Olos said quietly. The official version. The one that will have documentary evidence to support it. The one that will be believed.
Gergay grinned broadly.
I'd be delighted to help, of course. I shall regard it as a challenge to produce a definitively abject interview for popular consumption. I'll even help you work out positions so awful even I can't get out of them.
He raised his glass to them.
After all, it's the game that matters, is it not?
Harmin snorted. His shoulders shook. He sucked on the pipe again and through a veil of smoke said,
No true game player could say more.
He patted Gergay on the shoulder.
Mr. Gergay, even if you choose not to avail yourself of the facilities my house has to offer, I hope you'll stay with us for a while. I should enjoy talking with you. Will you stay?
Why not? Gergay said, and he and Harmin raised their glasses to each other. Olos sat back, laughing silently. Together, the three turned to watch the dancers, who had now formed a copulatorily complicated pattern of bodies in a carnal jigsaw, still keeping, Gergay was impressed to note, to the beat of the music. He stayed at the house for the next 15 days. He talked, guardedly, with the old rector during that time. He still felt they didn't really know each other when he left, but perhaps they knew a little more of each other's societies. Harmin obviously found it hard to believe the culture really did do without money.
But what if I do want something unreasonable?
What?
My own planet!
Harmin wheezed with laughter.
How can you own a planet?
Gergay shook his head.
But supposing I wanted one?
I suppose if you found an unoccupied one, you could land without anybody becoming annoyed. Perhaps that would work. But how would you stop other people landing there too?
Could I not buy a fleet of warships?
All our ships are sentient.
You could certainly try telling a ship what to do, but I don't think you'd get very far.
Your ships think they're sentient.
Harmin chuckled. A common delusion shared by some of our human citizens. Harmin found the culture's sexual mores even more fascinating. He was at once delighted and outraged that the culture regarded homosexuality, incest, sex-changing, hermaphrodisy, and sexual characteristic alteration as just something else people did, like going on a cruise or changing their hairstyle. Harmin thought this must take all the fun out of things. Didn't the culture forbid anything? Gergay attempted to explain there were no written laws, but almost no crime anyway. There was the occasional crime of passion, as Harmin chose to call it, but little else. It was difficult to get away with anything anyway, when everybody had a terminal. But there were very few motives left, too.
But if someone kills somebody else?
Gergay shrugged. Their slap droned.
Ah, this sounds more like it. What does this drone do?
Follows you around and makes sure you never do it again.
Is that all?
What more do you want? Social death, Harmin. You don't get invited to too many parties.
Ah, but in your culture, can't you gate crash?
Well, I suppose so, Gergay conceded, but nobody had talked to you.
As for what Harmin told Gergay about the Empire, it only made him appreciate what Shehobaham Zar had said, that it was a gem, however vicious and indiscriminate its cutting edges might be. It was not so difficult to understand the warped view the Azadians had of what they called human nature, the phrase they used whenever they had to justify something inhuman and unnatural, when they were surrounded and subsumed by the self-created monster that was the Empire of Azad, and which displayed such a fierce instinct, Gurgi could think of no other word, for self-preservation. The Empire wanted to survive. It was like an animal, a massive, powerful body that would only let certain cells or viruses survive within it, and, as a matter of course, killed off any and all others automatically and unthinkingly. Harmin himself used this analogy when he compared revolutionaries to cancer. Gurge tried to say that single cells were single cells, while a conscious collection of hundreds of billions of them, or a conscious device made from arrays of picocircuitry for that matter, was simply incomparable. But Harmin refused to listen. It was Gurge, not he, who'd missed the point. The rest of the time, Gurge spent walking in the forest or swimming in the warm, slack sea. The slow rhythm of Harmin's house was built around meals, and Gurge learned to take great care in dressing for these, eating them, talking to the guests, old and new as people came and went, and relaxing afterward, bloated and spacey, continuing to talk and watching the deliberate entertainment of usually erotic dances and the involuntary cabaret of changing sexual alliances among the guests, dancers, servants, and house staff. Gurge was enticed many times, but never tempted. He found the Azadian females more and more attractive all the time, and not just physically, but used his genifixed glands in a negative, even contrary way, to stay carnally sober in the midst of the subtly exhibited orgy around him. A pleasant enough few days. The rings did not jab him, and nobody shot at him. He and Fleer Imsaho got back safely to the module on the roof of the Grand Hotel a couple of days before the Imperial fleet was due to depart for Ikronidal. Gurge and the drone would have preferred to take the module, which was perfectly capable of making the crossing by itself, but contact forbidden that. The effect on the Admiralty of discovering that something no larger than a lifeboat could outstrip their battlecruisers was not something to be contemplated. And the Empire had refused permission for the alien machine to be conveyed inside an Imperial craft. So Gurge would have to make the journey with the fleet like everybody else.
"You think you've got problems," Fleer Imsaho said bitterly. "They'll be watching us all the time, on the liner during the crossing, and then once we're in the castle. That means I've got to stay inside this ridiculous disguise all day and all night until the games are over. Why couldn't you have lost in the first round like you were supposed to? We could have told them where to insert their fire planet and be back in the GSV by now."
"Oh, shut up, machine."
As it turned out, they needn't have returned to the module. There was nothing more to take or pack. He stood in the small lounge, fiddling with the orbital bracelet on his wrist, and realizing he was looking forward to the coming games on Ikronidal more than he had any of the others. The pressure would be off. He wouldn't have to face the opprobrium of the press and the Empire's ghastly general public. He could cooperate with the Empire to produce a convincing piece of fake news, and the likelihood of more physical option bets had thereby been reduced almost to zero. He was going to enjoy himself. Fleer Imsaho was glad to see the man was getting over the effects of seeing behind the screen the Empire showed its guests. He was much as he'd been before, and the days at Harmin's estate seemed to have relaxed him. It could see a small change in him, though, something it could not quite pin down, but which it knew was there. They didn't see Shehobaham Zah again. He'd left on a tour, up country, wherever that was. He sent his regards and a message in Moraine to the effect that if Gurge could lay his mitts on some fresh griff. Before they left, Gurge asked the module about the girl he'd met at the Grand Ball months earlier. He couldn't remember her name, but if the module could provide a list of the females who'd survived the first round, he was sure he'd recognize hers. The module got confused, but Fleer Imsaho told them both to forget it. No women had made it to the second round. Pequil came with them to the shuttleport. His arm was fully healed. Gurge and Fleer Imsaho bade farewell to the module. It climbed into the sky for a rendezvous with a distant limiting factor. They said goodbye to Pequil, too. He took Gurge's hand in both of his, and then the man and the drone boarded the shuttle. Gurge watched Grosnacek as it fell away beneath them. The city tilted as he was thrown back into his seat. The whole view swung and juddered as the shuttlecraft powered into the hazy skies. Gradually, all the patterns and the shapes came out, revealed for a while before the increasing distance The city's own vapours, dust and grime, and the altering angle of their climb, took it all away. For all the jumble, it looked momentarily peaceful and ordered in its parts. The distance made its individual local confusions and dislocations disappear, and from a certain height, where little ever dallied, and almost everything just passed through, it looked exactly like a great, mindless, spreading organism. Part 3. Machina ex machina.
So far, so average. Our gameplay has lucked out again. I guess you can see he's a changed man, though. These humans. I'm going to be consistent, however. I haven't told you who I am so far, and I'm not going to tell you now either. Maybe later. Maybe. Does identity matter anyway? I have my doubts. We are what we do, not what we think. Only the interactions count. There's no problem with free will here, that's not incompatible with believing your actions define you. And what is free will, anyway? Chance. The random factor. If one is not ultimately predictable, then of course that's all it can be. I get so frustrated with people who can't see this. Even a human should be able to understand it's obvious. The result is what matters, not how it's achieved. Unless, of course, the process of achieving is itself a series of results. What difference does it make whether a mind's made up of enormous, squidgy animal cells working at the speed of sound, in air, or from a glittering nanofoam of reflectors and patterns of holographic coherence at light speed? Let's not even think about a mind. Each is a machine, each is an organism, each fulfills the same task. Just matter, switching energy of one sort or another. Switches, memory. The random element, that is chance, and that is called choice, common denominators, all. I say again, you is what you done. Dynamic misbehaviorism, that's my creed. Gergay, his switches are working funny. He's thinking differently, acting uncharacteristically. He is a different person. He's seen the worst that meat grinder of a city could provide, and he just took it personally and took his revenge. Now he's spaceborne again, head crammed full of Azad rules, his brain adapted and adapting to the swirling, switching patterns of that seductive, encompassing, feral set of rules and possibilities, and being carted through space toward the Empire's most creakily symbolic shrine, Ikronidal, the place of the standing wave of flame, the fire planet. But will our hero prevail? Can he possibly prevail? And what would constitute winning anyway? How much has the man still got to learn? What will he make of such knowledge? More to the point, what will it make of him? Wait and see. It'll work itself out in time. Take it from there, maestro.
Ikronidal was 20 light-years from Ir. Halfway there, the Imperial fleet left the region of dust that lay between Ir's system and the direction of the main galaxy, and so that vast armed spiral was spread over half the sky like a million jewels caught in a whirlpool. Gergay was impatient to get to the fire planet. The journey seemed to take forever, and the liner he was making it on was hopelessly cramped. He spent most of the time in his cabin. The bureaucrats, Imperial officials, and other game players on the ship regarded him with undisguised dislike, and apart from a couple of shuttle trips over to the battlecruiser Invincible, the Imperial flagship, for receptions, Gergay didn't socialize. The crossing was made without incident, and after 12 days they arrived over Ikronidal, a planet orbiting a yellow dwarf in a fairly ordinary system, and itself a human habitable world with only one peculiarity. It was not unusual to find distinct equatorial bulges on once fast-spinning planets, and Ikronidal's was comparatively slight, though sufficient to produce a single unbroken continental ribbon of land lying roughly between the planet's tropics, the rest of the globe lying beneath two great oceans, ice-capped at the poles. What was unique, in the experience of the culture as well as the Empire, was to discover a wave of fire forever moving round the planet on the continental landmass. Taking about half a standard year to complete its circumnavigation, the fire swept over the land, its fringes brushing the shores of the two oceans, its wavefront a near straight line, its flames consuming the growth of the plants which had flourished in the ashes of the previous blaze. The whole land-based ecosystem had evolved around this never-ending conflagration. Some plants could only sprout from beneath the still warm cinders, their seeds jolted into development by the passing heat. Other plants blossomed just before the fire arrived, bursting into rapid growth just before the flames found them, and using the fire front's thermals to transport their seeds into the upper atmosphere, to fall back again somewhere onto the ash. The land animals of Ikronidel fell into three categories. Some kept constantly on the move, maintaining the same steady walking pace as the fire. Some swam round its oceanic boundaries, while other species burrowed into the ground, hid in caves, or survived through a variety of mechanisms in lakes or rivers. Birds circled the world like a jet stream of feathers. The blaze remained little more than a large, continuous bushfire for 11 revolutions. On the 12th, it changed. The cinderbud was a tall, skinny plant which grew quickly once its seeds had germinated. It developed an armoured base and shot up to a height of 10 meters or more in the 200 days it had before the flames came round again. When the fire did arrive, the cinderbud didn't burn. It closed its leafy head until the blaze had passed, then kept on growing in the ashes. After 11 of those great months, 11 baptisms in the flames, the cinderbuds were great trees, anything up to 70 meters in height. Their own chemistry then produced first the oxygen season, and then the incandescence. And in that sudden cycle, the fire didn't walk, it sprinted. It was no longer a wide but low and even mild bushfire, it was an inferno. Lakes disappeared, rivers dried, rocks crumbled in its baking heat. Every animal that had evolved its own way of dodging or keeping pace with the fires of the great months had had to find another method of surviving, running fast enough to build up a sufficient lead on the incandescence to still keep ahead of it, swimming far out into the ocean or to the few mostly small islands off the coasts, or hibernating deep in great cave systems or on the beds of deep rivers, lakes and fjords. Plants, too, switched to new survival mechanisms, rooting deeper, growing thicker seed cases, or equipping their thermal seeds for higher, longer flight, and the baked ground they would encounter on landing. For a great month thereafter, the planet, its atmosphere choked with smoke, soot and ash, wavered on the edge of catastrophe as smoke clouds blocked out the sun and the temperature plummeted. Then, slowly, while the diminished small fire continued on its way, the atmosphere cleared. The animals started to breed again, the plants grew once more, and the little cinderbuds started sprouting through the ashes from the old root complexes. The Empire's castles on Ikronidel, extravagantly sprinkled and doused, had been built to survive whatever terrible heat and screaming winds the planet's bizarre ecology could provide. And it was in the greatest of those fortresses, Castle Claff, that for the last 300 standard years, the final games of Azad had been played, timed to coincide, whenever possible, with the incandescence. The Imperial fleet arrived above Ikronidel in the middle of the oxygen season. The flagship remained over the planet while the escorting battleships dispersed to the outskirts of the system. The liners stayed until the Invincible's shuttle squadron had ferried the game players, court officials, guests and observers down to the surface, then left for a nearby system. The shuttles dropped through the clear air of Ikronidel to land at Castle Claff. The fortress lay on a spur of rock at the foot of a range of soft, well-worn hills overlooking a broad plain. Normally, it looked out over a horizon-wide sweep of low scrub punctuated by the thin towers of cinderbuds at whatever stage they'd reached. But now the cinderbuds had branched and blossomed, and their canopy of rippling leaves fluttered over the plain like some rooted yellow overcast, and the tallest trunks rose higher than the castle's curtain wall. When the incandescence arrived, it would wash around the fortress like a livid wave. All that ever saved the castle from incineration was a 2-kilometer viaduct leading from a reservoir in the low hills to Claff itself, where giant cisterns and a complicated system of sprinklers ensured the secured and shuttered fortress was drenched with water as the fire passed. If the dousing system ever broke down, there were deep shelters in the rock far underneath the castle which would house the inhabitants until the burning was over. So far, the waters had always saved the fortress, and it had remained an oasis of scorched yellow in a wilderness of fire. The Emperor, whoever had won the final game, was traditionally meant to be in Claff when the fire passed, to rise from the fortress after the flames died, ascending through the darkness of the smoke clouds to the darkness of space, and thence to his empire. The timing hadn't always worked out perfectly, and in earlier centuries, the Emperor and his court had had to sit out the fire in another castle, or even missed the incandescence altogether. However, the Empire had this time calculated correctly, and it looked as though the incandescence, due to start only 200 kilometers fireward of the castle, where the cinderbuds changed abruptly from their normal size and shape to the huge trees that surrounded Clath, would arrive more or less on time to provide a suitable backdrop for the coronation. Gyrgy felt uncomfortable as soon as they landed. Ear had been of just a little less than what the culture rather arbitrarily regarded as standard mass, so its gravity had felt roughly the equivalent of the force Chark Orbital had produced by rotating, and the limiting factor and the little rascal had created with AG fields. But Ikronidal was half as massive again as Ear, and Gyrgy felt heavy. The castle had long since been equipped with slow-accelerating elevators, and it was unusual to see anybody other than male servants climbing upstairs, but even walking on the level was uncomfortable for the first few of the planet's short days. Gerge's rooms overlooked one of the castle's inner courtyards. He settled in there with Fleer Imseho, who gave no sign of being affected by the higher gravity, and the male servant every finalist was entitled to. Gyrgy had voiced some uncertainty about having a servant at all.
"Yeah," the drone had said, "who needs two?"
But it had been explained it was traditional and a great honour for the male, so he'd acquiesced. There was a rather desultory party on the night of their arrival. Everybody sat around talking, tired after the long journey and drained by the fierce gravity. The conversation was mostly about swollen ankles. Gyrgy went briefly to show his face. It was the first time he'd met Nikosar since the grand ball at the start of the games. The receptions on the Invincible during the journey had not been graced by the Imperial presence.
"This time, get it right,"
Flea Imseho told him as they entered the main hall of the castle. The Emperor sat on a throne, welcoming the people as they arrived. Gyrgy was about to kneel like everyone else, but Nikosar saw him, shook one ringed finger, and pointed at his own knee.
"Our one need, friend, you have not forgotten."
Gyrgy knelt on one knee, bowing his head. Nikosar laughed thinly. Harmin, sitting on the Emperor's right, smiled. Gyrgy sat alone in a chair by a wall, near a large suit of antique armour. He looked unenthusiastically round the room and ended up gazing, with a frown, at an apex standing in one corner of the hall, talking to a group of uniformed apices perched on stool seats around him. The apex was unusual not just because he was standing, but because he seemed to be encased in a set of gunmetal bones worn outside his navy uniform.
"Who's that?"
Gyrgy asked Fleer Imseho, humming and crackling unenthusiastically between his chair and the suit of armour by the wall.
"Who's who?"
"That apex with the exoskeleton? Is that what you call it? Him?"
"That is Star Marshal Yomanul. In the last games he made a personal bet with Nikosar's blessing that he would go to prison for a great year if he lost. He lost. But he expected that Nikosar would use the Imperial veto, which he can do on wages which aren't body bets, because the Emperor wouldn't want to lose the services of one of his best commanders for 6 years. Nikosar did use the veto, but only to have Yamanul incarcerated in that device he's wearing, rather than shut away in a prison cell. The portable prison is proto-sentient. It has various independent senses as well as conventional exoskeleton features, such as a micropile and powered limbs. Its job is to leave Yamanul free to carry out his military duties, but otherwise to impose prison discipline on him. It will only let him eat a little of the simplest food, allows him no alcohol, keeps him to a strict regimen of exercise, will not allow him to take part in social activities. His presence here this evening must mark some sort of special dispensation by the Emperor, and won't let him copulate. In addition, he has to listen to sermons by a prison chaplain, who visits him for 2 hours every 10 days.
Poor guy. I see he has to stand as well.
Well, one shouldn't try to outsmart the Emperor, I guess,
Flea Imseho said.
But his sentence is almost over.
No time off for good behavior.
The Imperial Penal Service does not deal in discounts. They do add time on if you behave badly, though.
Gyrgy shook his head, looking at the distant prisoner in his private prison.
It's a mean old empire, isn't it, drone?
Mean enough. But if it ever tries to fuck with the culture, it'll find out what mean really is.
Gyrgy looked round in surprise at the machine. It floated, buzzing there, its bulky grey and brown casing looking hard and even sinister against the dull gleam of the empty suit of armour.
My, we're in a combative mood this evening.
I am. You'd better be.
For the games. I'm ready.
Are you really going to take part in this piece of propaganda?
What piece of propaganda?
You know damn well. helping the Bureau to fake your own defeat, pretending you've lost, giving interviews and lying.
Yes, why not? It lets me play the game. They might try to stop me otherwise.
Kill you?
Gergay shrugged. Disqualify me.
Is it worth so much to keep playing?
No, Gergay lied. But telling a few white lies isn't much of a price either.
Hmph,
the machine said. Gergay waited for it to say more, but it didn't. They left a little later. Gergay got up out of the chair and walked to the door, only remembering to turn and bow toward Nikasar after the drone prompted him. His first game on Akronidal, the one he was officially to lose no matter what happened, was another 10-game. This time, there was no suggestion of anybody ganging up on him, and he was approached by four of the other players to form a side which would oppose the rest. This was the traditional way of playing 10 games, though it was the first time Gergay had been directly involved, apart from being on the sharp end of other people's alliances. So he found himself discussing strategy and tactics with a pair of fleet admirals, a star general, and an imperial minister in what the Bureau guaranteed was an electronically and optically sterile room in one wing of the castle. They spent 3 days talking over how they would play the game. Then they swore before God, and Gergay gave his word, they would not break the agreement until the other 5 players had been defeated or they themselves were brought down. The lesser games ended with the sides about even. Gergay found there were advantages and disadvantages in playing as part of an ensemble. He did his best to adapt and play accordingly. More talks followed. Then they joined battle on the board of origin. Gergay enjoyed it. It added a lot to the game to play as part of a team. He felt genuinely warm toward the apices he played alongside. They came to each other's aid when they were in trouble, they trusted one another during massed attacks, and generally played as though their individual forces were really a single side. As people, he didn't find his comrades desperately engaging, but as playing partners, he could not deny the emotion he felt for them, and experienced a growing sense of sadness as the game progressed and they gradually beat back their opponents, that they would soon all be fighting each other. When it came to it, and the last of the opposition had surrendered, much of what Gergay had felt before disappeared. He'd been at least partially tricked. He'd stuck to what he saw as the spirit of their agreement, while the others stuck to the letter. Nobody actually attacked until the last of the other team's pieces had been captured or taken over, but there was some subtle manoeuvring when it became clear they were going to win, playing for positions that would become more important when the team agreement ended. Gergay missed this until it was almost too late, and when the second part of the game began, he was by far the weakest of the 5. It also became obvious that the 2 admirals were, not surprisingly, cooperating unofficially against the others. Jointly, the pair were stronger than the other 3. In a way, Gergay's very weakness saved him. He played so that it was not worth taking him for a long time, letting the other 4 fight it out. Later, he attacked the 2 admirals when they had grown strong enough to threaten a complete takeover, but were more vulnerable to his small force than to the greater powers of the general and the minister. The game to'd and fro'd for a long time, but Gergay was gaining steadily, and eventually, though he was put out first of the 5, he'd accumulated sufficient points to ensure he'd play on the next board. 3 of the other original 5-side had done so badly they had to resign from the match. Gergay never really fully recovered from his mistake on the first board, and did badly on the board of form. It was starting to look as though the Empire would not need to lie about him being thrown out of the first game. He still talked to the limiting factor, using Fleer Imsaho as a relay and the game screen in his own room for the display. He felt he'd adjusted to the higher gravity. Fleer Imsaho had to remind him it was a gene-affixed response. His bones were rapidly thickening, and his musculature had expanded without waiting to be otherwise exercised.
"Hadn't you noticed you were getting more thick-set?" the drone said in exasperation, while
Gergay studied his body in the room mirror. Gergay shook his head. "I did think I was eating rather a lot."
"Very observant. I wonder what else you can do you don't know about. Didn't they teach you anything about your own biology?"
The man shrugged. "I forgot." He adjusted, too, to the planet's short day-night cycle, adapting faster than anybody else, if the numerous complaints were anything to go by. Most people, the drone told him, were using drugs to bring themselves into line with their 3/4 standard day. "Gene fixing again?" Gergay asked at breakfast one morning.
"Yes, of course."
"I didn't know we could do all this."
"Obviously not," the drone said. "Good grief, man. The culture's been a spacefaring species for 11,000 years. Just because you've mostly settled down in idealized, tailor-made conditions
doesn't mean you've lost the capacity for rapid adaptation. Strength in depth, redundancy, over-design. You know the culture's philosophy.
Gergay frowned at the machine. He gestured to the walls and then to his ear. Fleer Imseho wobbled from side to side. Drone shrug. Gergay came fifth out of seven on the board of form. He started play on the board of becoming with no hope of winning, but a remote chance of getting through as the qualifier. He played an inspired game toward the end. He was starting to feel quite thoroughly at home on the last of the three great boards, and enjoyed using the elemental symbolism the play incorporated instead of the die matching used in the rest of each match. The board of becoming was the least well played of the three great boards, Gergay felt, and one the Empire seemed to understand imperfectly and pay too little attention to. He made it. One of the admirals won, and he scraped in as qualifier. The margin between him and the other admiral was 1 point, 5,523 against 5,522. Only a draw and playoff could have been closer, but when he thought about it later, he realized he hadn't for one moment entertained the slightest doubt he'd get through to the next round.
"You're coming perilously close to talking about destiny, Jernar Gergay,"
Fleer Imseho said when he tried to explain this. He was sitting in his room, hand on the table in front of him, while the drone removed the orbital bracelet from his wrist. He couldn't get it over his hand anymore, and it was becoming too tight, thanks to his expanding muscles.
"Destiny," Gergay said, looking thoughtful.
He nodded.
"That's what it feels like, I suppose."
"What next?"
exclaimed the machine, using a field to cut the bracelet. Gergay had expected the bright little image to disappear, but it didn't.
"God? Ghosts? Time travel?"
The drone drew the bracelet off his wrist and reconnected the tiny orbital so that it was a circle again. Gergay smiled. "The Empire." He took the bracelet from the machine, got up easily, and walked to the window, turning the orbital over in his hands and looking out into the stony courtyard.
"The Empire," thought Fleer Imseho.
It got Gergay to let it store the bracelet inside its casing. No sense in leaving it around. Somebody might guess what it represented.
"I do hope he's joking."
With his own game over, Gergay found time to watch Nikasar's match. The Emperor was playing in the prow hall of the fortress, a great bold room ribbed in grey stone and capable of seating over 1,000 people. It was here the last game would be played, the game which would decide who became Emperor. The prow hall lay at the far end of the castle, facing the direction the fire would come from. High windows, still unshuttered, looked out over the sea of yellow cinderbud heads outside. Gergay sat in one of the observation galleries, watching the Emperor play. Nikasar played cautiously, gradually building up advantages, playing the game in a percentage-wary way, setting up profitable exchanges on the board of becoming and orchestrating the moves of the other four players on his side. Gergay was impressed. Nikasar played a deceptive game. The slow, steady style he evinced here was only one side of him. Every now and again there would come, just when it was needed, exactly when it would have the most devastating effect, a move of startling brilliance and audacity. Equally, the occasional fine move by an opponent was always at least matched and usually bettered by the Emperor. Gergay felt some sympathy for those playing against Nikasar. Even playing badly was less demoralizing than playing sporadically excellently, but always being crushed.
"You're smiling, Janao Gergay."
Gergay had been absorbed in the game and hadn't seen Harmin approach. The old Apex sat down carefully beside him. Bulges under his robe showed he wore an AG harness to partially counteract Ikronadal's gravity.
"Good evening, Harmin."
"I heard you qualified. Well done."
"Thank you. Only unofficially, of course."
"Ah, yes. Officially, you came fourth."
"How unexpectedly generous."
"We took into account your willingness to cooperate. You will still help us."
"Of course. Just show me the camera."
"Perhaps tomorrow."
Harmin nodded, looking down to where Nikasar stood, surveying his commanding position on the board of becoming.
"Your opponent for the single game will be Lord Tenyos Crow, an excellent player. I warn you. Are you quite sure you don't want to drop out now?"
"Quite. Would you have me cause Bemoya's mutilation, only to give up now because the strain's getting too much?"
"I see your point, Gergay."
Harmin sighed, still watching the Emperor. He nodded.
"Yes, I see your point. And anyway, you only qualified by the narrowest of margins, and Lo Tenyo's crow is very, very good.
He nodded again.
Yes, perhaps you have found your level, eh?
The wizened face turned to Gergay. Very possibly, Rector. Harmin nodded absently and looked away again at his emperor. On the following morning, Gergay recorded some faked game board shots. The game he'd just played was set up again, and Gergay made some believable but uninspired moves and one outright mistake. The part of his opponents was taken by Harmin and a couple of the other senior Kansai College professors. Gergay was impressed by how well they were able to mimic the game styles of the apices he'd been playing against. As had, in effect, been foretold, Gergay finished fourth. He recorded an interview with the Imperial News Service, expressing his sorrow at being knocked out of the main series, and saying how grateful he was for having had the chance to play the game of Azad. The experience of a lifetime. He was eternally in the debt of the Azadian people. His respect for the Emperor Regent's genius had increased immeasurably from his already high starting point. He looked forward to observing the rest of the games. He wished the Emperor, his empire, and all its people and subjects the very best for what would undoubtedly be a bright and prosperous future. The news team and Harmin seemed well pleased.
You should have been an actor, General Gergay, Harmin told him.
Gergay assumed this was intended as a compliment. He sat looking out over the forest of cinderbuds. The trees were 60 meters high or more. At their peak rate, the drone had told him, they grew at nearly a quarter meter per day, sucking